Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The 350th anniversary of Peter the Great's birth is June 9. He ruled from 1682 to 1725 and founded the city of St. Petersburg as Russia's window to Europe. Has his dream of Russia being part of Europe come to an end? At this point, this seems very likely. Crosstalking Russia and Europe, I'm joined by my guest, John Laughlin in Paris. He's a university lecturer in history and political philosophy. In St. Petersburg, we have Gilbert Doctorow. He's an independent political analyst and author of memoirs of an expat manager in Moscow during the 1990s. And in Providence, we cross to Vladimir Goldstein. He is the chair of the Department of Slavic Studies at Brown University. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. I want to ask you all three the same question, and I'll start off with John here. Is the window to Europe that Peter the Great envisioned, is it coming to a close? Is it closed?
Yes, it's been slammed by Europe. Russia, throughout the last 10, 20 years, has repeatedly said how much it wants to cooperate with the West, with Europe in particular, of course, but even with the Americans. And, you know, the door has been slammed in its face, or the window has been slammed in its face in a very, very fundamental way. As Angela Merkel used to remind people, even at the height of the Cold War, when there was a very acute ideological confrontation between communism and capitalism, economic relations continued between the Soviet Union and the West, particularly in the form of energy supplies. And as we all know, those have now been largely cut off. Not yet the energy supplies, but all other forms of economic cooperation. And as we know, some countries are pushing for even the energy to go. And the reason why I say it's slammed, and I think definitively, I mean, nothing is ever definitive in history, but certainly for the medium and even long term, is that this crisis occurs at the end of a 30-year period after the Cold War, where relations have gone from cool to very cold, indeed frozen, from bad to worse. That 30-year period followed the Cold War itself, which had lasted 45, 50 years. And the Cold War followed, of course, the two world wars. Although Russia and then the Soviet Union fought on the Allied side in both those conflicts, they both were essentially wars fought between Europe, or at least Central Europe, in the case of the First World War, and Russia. It's often forgotten. This point is often overlooked, particularly from a Western perspective, because if you're British or French, you know about the trenches on the Western Front. But the war on Russia, for example, in 1914, the first declaration of war was by Austria against Serbia, and the second declaration of war on the 1st of August 1914 was by Germany against Russia. So the focus of those two world wars, and of course even more so in the Second World War, was between Europe and Russia. And as I say, while the Soviet Union then from 41 to 45 was, of course, on the Allied side, that was a small parenthesis. And so, in other words, if you look at it in the round, we've had now more than 100 years of major and constant geopolitical, not constant, but very largely constant geopolitical confrontation between Europe generally and Russia. And that has now come to a head with this latest war in a way that few people foresaw, and in a way which I do indeed think is absolutely fundamental and would be very, very difficult to row back from.
It's very interesting. It's got Vladimir here. I would just give an extra caveat to what John was saying, is that the current iteration of the window being slammed shut is at the Americans' behest. I think it's important to point out. Right, cool. Okay. Vladimir, the same question to you. I mean, being from the former Soviet Union, now living in the West, you and I are a very interesting couple because I'm an American living here, you're a former Soviet citizen living there. Is this an end game here? Because it seems to me that the West is determined to deny Russia any access to Europe. It's definitive, and it could last generations. Go ahead, Vladimir.
Yeah, I would agree with your the starting point that this is basically a United States game, that Russia is in Europe, and it's definitely like violent action as a slamming the door into Russia's face. in Europe. I don't think it will last. Integration and connections are way too strong. But the United States is driving it, being away from Europe, being away from Russia. It sort of, you know, wants to maintain this status quo which existed during the Cold War and so on, when the United States was the leader. For the United States, the globalism meant that, you know, we're in charge. It meant United States hegemony, and they want to maintain it. But this is kind of two impossible points, to have kind of global things and to have one country dominated. So they're trying to persist and preserve it while it's actually crumbling. But this is one more attempt. They're using Ukraine as a wedge to drive between Europe and Russia, between Germany and Russia. And, you know, they are succeeding somewhat. But it's, you know, if we look, you know, it's very good to go back to Peter the Great and see that certain things are inevitable. Geography is a destiny. And Peter understood it. And, you know, Europeans understand it. For the time being, a lot of Europeans are still under this fog of United States, that we can do it, we can put Russia in its place. Yeah,
but no, Vladimir. If the geography is destiny, then the Europeans should understand it, but they don't. And that is the problem here. Let's go to Gilbert. Same question, so we have everyone answering the same question. Go ahead, Gilbert.
Well, I would take the comments of our first panelist a bit further back. If you listen to people on the street here, if you listen to your taxi driver, hairdresser, who alone have the right to talk politics, and other people are very quiet because they don't want to make enemies of people they know. If you listen to those who are talking, you'll hear an expression fairly commonly that every 100 years or so, Europeans take it into their heads to destroy Russia. And so we go back a little further than the First World War. We go back to 1812. It was a week ago, there was a revival of a legacy opera production here in St. Petersburg, the Mariinsky Theater. It was the production of Prokofiev's War and Peace based on Tolstoy's novel. And that is very much the thinking of people in this city, the city which is, after all, what Peter the Great founded and was created to be precisely that window on Europe. Here, people do recall the words of Tolstoy, the notion that all of Europe was coming to Russia and coming to Moscow for the sake of spoils, war spoils, and the destruction of this country. So that thinking about the depth of experience in hostilities with Europe is very widespread. And also, in that vein, I don't think that there is the belief that the present troubles will last forever, and certainly not last generations. I personally think of a five-year timeline before sanity returns in Europe, and we're much too early to see the rethinking of these insane policies as a consequence of the full blowback that is still to come. The European leadership is very inexperienced. All of it, the whole EU leadership, starting with Mr. Scholz and going down the whole line of the coalition governments that have agreed, like so many ducks in a line, to implement all of the cruel and rather stupid restrictions on Russia. These have not yet yielded the blowback that is yet to come. When that comes, there will be reflection.
Yes, let me go back to John here. I mean, the conflict in Ukraine will come to an end, I would predict, basically at the end of this summer, an utter defeat for Ukraine. Ukraine doesn't want to negotiate, so the Russians will dictate their terms. But, John, NATO will still exist, and it will want its revenge, okay? I mean, people are so focused on this here, which is important, obviously, but that's why we're doing this program, because I think the implications of this conflict, if NATO isn't defanged American hegemony doesn't come to an end, we're going to continue this. It'll be the first Ukrainian war. John, go ahead.
There's absolutely no doubt about that. And, of course, as we all know, this current war is itself a response to what happened in 2014 on both sides, the Maidan coup and then the annexation of Crimea and so on. NATO was rearming Ukraine, as we all know, from 2014 onwards. was no doubt preparing an attack on the Donbass this year, and so on and so forth. So, yes, all these things continue. And were Russia to achieve its aims, as I think she probably will this summer, as you say, then, of course, NATO will prepare its revenge. That's how international relations work. And I think that's all the more certain to happen, because while I agree with you completely about the Americans being in the driving seat about this, the Europeans are not only servile. They are servile, but they are ideologically committed to this.
Yep.
When people like Ursula von der Leyen and so on, who, by the way, when she was appointed president of the European Commission in 2019, promised a geopolitical commission, And when she was defense minister of Germany before that, she promised to make the German army the biggest army in Europe.
Oh, God.
So these ideas, and by the way, a promise which Olaf Scholz has repeated, Germany is rearming. And rearming in the sense of wanting to affirm itself ideologically as what Europe is today, which is, as I've said many times before, including on this show, post-national, post-Christian, post-historical, and so on. And Russia is the ideological enemy. Russia is, by its very existence, a threat to the European ideology, because Russia, of course, is the opposite of all those things. And if one country can be seen to be doing the opposite of being post-historical and post-national and so on, then that is a threat to the ideology, because ideology cannot bear a counter-ideology to exist alongside it.
And so it's an extension.
We mustn't underestimate the role of the Europeans. They are in this up to their necks, and they want it for the same reasons, because they are on the same ideological line as, for example, the Biden administration in Washington.
All right, on that point, gentlemen, we're going to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Russia and Europe. Stay with RT.
Today, I'm authorizing additional strong sanctions.
Foreign companies are quitting Russia.
Haben wir Sanktionen verhängt, die ihresgleichen suchen.
ATM cards were blocked and banks disconnected from the international payment system.
Ces sanctions vont frapper durement la Russie.
Dollar and euro exchange rates followed.
У меня поначалу была паника, думала, что все, как мы будем работать.
Время тревог наступило, когда стали закрывать границы.
Подорожало все, все материалы, которые мы используем.
Can Russian business overcome this?
Санкции не работают. Для нас это хороший инструмент. Сейчас мы должны производить больше наших продуктов, наш сыр, наша мебель.
В России такой потенциал, который ни у кого нет. Мы потом еще сделаем такой экспорт, который никогда не было.
Мы понимаем, что действительно от российского производителя ждут реального поставки лекарств. Теперь такое понимание, если не мы, то кто?
Нам не страшен никакой кризис, потому что мы проходили уже. Мы готовы работать. Я думаю, что мы прорвемся.
Обстреливают, конечно, украинские войска.
Все горело, трубы валяются, людей военных, все, дети орут, плачут, мы под пулями шли.
Националисты просто вот дома рушили, людей просто мясом с них делали.
И все это время азовцы просто прятались за нами. Мы были живая стена их, и все.
Как только уничтожаются неонацисты, украинская армия просто сложит оружие.
Украина говорит, наш Донбасс. Почему он свой Донбасс, вот Украина, била? Сколько лет? Издевалась?
Да или их так настроили, или я не знаю, такая вот, что они озлоблены, то, что вот именно за нас заступились.
Российские войска нас освободили. Да, это ужас, я не могу разговаривать. Там жизни не было.
Там все сгорело везде, к вам пешком тут шли, да вот, ну. Плачу, потому что рады, то, что это уже все прошло наконец-то.
Мы, наверное, тоже настрадались за 8 лет. Рано или поздно этому всему должен прийти конец.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Russia and Europe. Well, the worst thing about this program is that when you have three great guests, you have so little time. So I'm going to keep out of it. Vladimir, pick up the discussion where we left off. Go ahead.
Well, I think what we see in here is what, you know, like well-known sort of concept of contradictions. There are a lot of contradictions here. There's, what we have is definitely some kind of European elites which decided a long time ago to align themselves with the United States. And they follow them ideologically. They follow them, you know, politically and militarily and so on. But Europe is definitely not a kind of as monolithic as they pretend to be. There are business interests. There are people interests. There is like some kind of ideology. So these things will enter into conflict. And, you know, people would realize they need, you know, access sort of to Russia, to Russian wealth, to Russian sort of spiritual wealth, to Russia's cultural wealth, to, you know, they need Russia to be involved in solving fundamental issues like, you know, climate, for example. Furthermore, the very ideology of this kind of post, you know, that John referred to, this kind of postmodern world is a very contradictory thing by itself, because what United States, the driving ideology, is certain kind of equality. They want to bring some kind of marginalized groups in, while at the same time, they try and fully marginalize Russia, giant country with giant, you know, with people. They're mistreating them. They don't allow traveling both ways. And this is so, you know, sooner or later, even these ideologues that would realize that you cannot do that. This is just, you cannot with one hand promote equality and, you know, bringing in all, you know, marginalized left out groups while at the same time marginalizing the greatest, biggest country, at least in size. So this sooner or later, it will start sinking in both among the European elite. And, of course, definitely among European people.
Well, I just saw John Laughlin disagree. I disagree, too, but I want to get Gilbert in here. I'm just going to cut to the chase. I mean, Europe needs Russia far more than Russia needs Europe. Can't people understand that? Gilbert.
Well, I think the operation in Ukraine may have unsettled nerves in European capitals, because when they looked at what they had in the larger, where they look at what they have by way of military strength, they have nothing. NATO without the United States is fairly worthless. They don't have their own equipment anymore. They've been dependent on purchases from the United States, which destroyed the military industry domestically. And they had very little, the Germans in particular, had very little to defend themselves, save the American presence. And that is why they have lined up so many ducks behind the Biden administration. I take issue with the remarks of our first speaker that there's something potentially alarming about Germany rearming. If Germany rearms, then potentially it can be an independent force from the United States. And whereas now it is utterly impossible for Germany to step out of line behind what the United States is proposing, since it has no defense capability of its own. Therefore, we are at a turning point, many turning points, in relations within Europe, in relations between the United States and Europe, and relations between Europe and Russia. Will things improve in relations with Russia? As I said, the blowback is still to come. The economic catastrophe that the European governments have been preparing by their package of sanctions has yet to yield its results. Does Russia need Europe? Of course it does economically. It would be quite painful for Europe to disappear as a consumer of Russian hydrocarbons.
Well, what about the other way around, Gilbert? What about the other way around? I think it would be far worse for Europe. Europe would suffer far more. Let me go to John here. I mean, okay, we have six packages of sanctions here. Well, there's one big sanction Russia can employ. Turn off the taps in a nanosecond. Turn it off. That's their sanction. John.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one wonders in a sense why it hasn't been deployed so far. But I think that the... What I meant about Ursula von der Leyen and German rearmament, I certainly don't want to suggest that Germany wants to be hegemonic in Europe on its own terms independently of the Americans. No, it is, of course, as part of this transatlantic alliance. But what I meant was that she, by saying this, by making the point about the geopolitical commission and rearming Germany earlier when she was defense minister, I meant that she clearly was building up in her mind this idea of a confrontation with Russia, because that's the only country against which there would be any geopolitical commission. And to go back to what Vladimir said in the States, I don't think we can, I think we're beyond the point now where we can expect, for instance, German industry or European industry to correct the suicidal mistakes of European policymakers. I never believed that the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline would be suspended as it has been, because I assumed that that was a yeah. matter of life and death for Germany. Well, it has now been suspended. And don't forget that this suspension occurs, we all know this, in the context of decades now of green policy. They're talking more and more about reducing CO2 emissions and using hydrocarbons. This is almost a windfall for them, this sudden Russia crisis, because they can start to implement their green policies. And we must never underestimate the power of ideology. Yeah. You know, in 1917, you could have said Soviet communism doesn't make any economic sense, but it took 70 years. It took many generations of terrible damage inflicted on Russia and on Soviet society before these contradictions, which of course are there. You talk about contradictions, Vladimir. Yes, they're there, but they can stay in place, these contradictions, for nearly a century while the economies of the countries concerned suffer under these contradictions. Contradictions don't necessarily collapse very quickly. And, you know, we see our crisis after crisis in Europe, and not just the Ukraine crisis, but also COVID, the monetary crisis of 2008. These things are often, as it were, responded to with decisions which, in fact, will lead to far worse crises down the line. But that doesn't stop these decisions from continuing to be taken. Reality is not getting through at this point. And that's what makes me so pessimistic about the about
reality is coming through this fall. Today's issue of La Libre Belgique shows that the price of a liter of mazout, fuel oil for heating, has gone to €1.47. That is double the price of last year, and it means that every household in Belgium will face a very punishing bill when it orders a delivery of oil. This will have a political consequence.
Yep.
For that reason, the insanity that has guided the governments of Western Europe has yet to hit. It will hit in September, October, when people take their fuel deliveries.
Okay, Vladimir, I mean, given, you know, the confiscation of Russian assets and whatnot, I mean, I'm not talking about yachts and stuff like that. I don't care about billionaires. I really don't. But a precedent has been set. The West is not a reliable partner. They don't believe in the rule of law anymore. So, I mean, again, I don't have any kind of historical attachment to this relationship here. I'm pragmatic, okay, and I'm not ideological. And so mixing up this ideology and then refuting your basic principles like the rule of law, I mean, why do you want to parlay with anyone like that, Vladimir?
Yeah, what we have to consider is that at the time of Peter the Great, of course, Europe was a kind of dominant force, at least technologically and so on, and he definitely wanted to turn toward Europe. But there is a like elephant in the room, you know, there is East, there is China, there is India. And eventually there'll be certain realignment. And that's what we're talking about, kind of the reality. This message which United States and Europe is sending, that they can seize the assets and so on, it's a very dangerous one. A message that they can send, that they can use one country for the proxy war, it's a very dangerous one. China definitely gets what the United States want to accomplish through Taiwan, through sort of Hong Kong and so on. So this is, we're living in a totally different world. And the reality is such that, okay, you know, you don't want Russian oil, fine. It can go, it can flow eastward. And then, you know, as Gilbert says, you know, Europeans will get a hard lesson. And I'm actually much more optimistic, for example, than John, having, you know, lived at the sort of, you know, at the dismantling of Soviet Union. I remember when I was there in the 70s, people thought that the Soviet Union will go on forever. But nevertheless, at that moment, and I don't want to go in the Soviet history, there were certain progressive moments at a certain time, but at least, you know, in the 70s, 80s, it was written sort of on the wall. The whole thing is dismantling, and we did achieve totally different country. So things are changing.
Okay,
and
so Vladimir, you're giving me hope. Let me go to China. So you, given what you know, the thought that the Soviet Union would never come to an end, communism would never come to an end. So John, do we have hope that the EU and NATO can come to an end, John?
Well, everything comes to an end eventually, particularly in politics. But I, as I say, I do not think that the end is in sight. We've seen NATO deciding to expand further in these last weeks. There's still a lot of life left in the system. Emmanuel Macron has just been re-elected in France, even though there's very little support for him. The system continues to prosper. And of course, I'm aware of the rising energy prices, and of course, I think the sanctions are suicidal. But I have thought that policy decisions going back more than 10 years was suicidal. I think quantitative easing is suicidal. But it's part of the program. At Davos last week, they talked about how there would be significant reductions in the standard of living all over the world because of the climate crisis and because of the response to it. That's part of the program. So if people have to pay more for their fuel oil, that suits the green agenda fine. And the green agenda is what dominates Europe and America at the moment. So that's why I'm afraid, of course, I wish reality would break in. But well, I don't see any sign of it.
John, we're rapidly
being.
Running out of time, but all of these people, the Davos ghouls, you know, they have all these great ideas, but they'll never suffer as a result of their own ideas, all right? Yes, that's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Paris, Providence, and in St. Petersburg. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.